beautiful morning you've provided, for the rest of the night, for the privileges that you've laid before us this day. Thank you that you've set aside one day every week that we can turn our attention in a special way to you and to your wonders, your creation, your revelation. And we ask you to bless our time together this morning. In Jesus' holy name, amen. Is it reasonable to believe that our God is alive in this age of enlightenment? I can tell you there are lots of folks who would say, no, it is not. Because the more we've learned about the explanation of how the natural world came about, the less is the need for God. Some would tell you that bringing God into the picture is like filling in the gaps of your ignorance. So God is not necessary in the eyes of many people in our age. So the answer to that question for some folks, too many folks, is no, it is not reasonable in this age of enlightenment. You're going back to the dark ages. We know that the Bible very clearly teaches it is reasonable. So Psalm 19, for example, says the following. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, night unto night reveals knowledge. There's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. There's no question what the Bible says about that. It says there is a testimony to the great God who made it in the natural world. I think the passage that says that most clearly is Romans chapter 1. I'm beginning this way because we're not in a science lecture room. This is a church assembly. If we were in a science lecture room, I would not start off by quoting Scripture. I would start by looking at the evidence of the natural world. But I think it's appropriate here and show you that Romans, the first chapter, teaches the very argument that we will be making today. Romans 1, verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." Well, that's the argument from design, ladies and gentlemen. It's the argument that design points to a designer. If you see things that sure appear to be made, then you look for a maker. So Romans 1:20 makes that argument. His invisible attributes, you cannot directly observe by scientific methods the existence of God. But can you observe them by the things that are made? And I would argue, yes, you can. That you can reason toward intelligent design based on the evidence of the natural world. And the only reason I'm saying this passage for you is because it argues you can learn that whatever this creator is, he must have eternal power and be of divine nature. That means something other than nature itself. He's beyond nature. We would call it supernatural. Those things you can learn from nature. You cannot learn from nature what this God wants you to do. You need revelation for that. But I believe you can learn evidence for his existence. Okay, so for the rest of my time in this class period, and for most of the time even during the worship hour, we're going to look at God's other book. Not this book. This is a book of revelation. And I'm convinced it's God's word. Don't misunderstand that. But there is another book that also testifies of God. It's the book of the natural world. So we're going to turn to that book. And I hope that isn't offensive to anyone. I think he has left powerful testimony in his other book that we can examine and come to a reasonable conclusion. All right. Do you think there's intelligent life somewhere else in the universe? That's an interesting question. I start this way because there's a whole lot of research being done on that very subject. There's an organization called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, or CETI for short. For 25 years, your tax dollars supported that project. And when they had found absolutely nothing in 25 years, they pulled the tax money, which I think is just as well. But they're still doing it. still looking. It continues this day with private funding. And so the question is, what kind of evidence would convince someone that there are extraterrestrials? And I think beginning with this question is a good way to begin this general subject. Can we use science to investigate evidence for intelligence? I believe we can. And here's an organization that's doing it, and they certainly are not believers in God. They're looking for signs of intelligence out there. There was an article in a recent newspaper about their recent activities, and they have a website. There it is. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So let me blow up a little bit of that first paragraph for you. Here's what it says. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an exploratory science. You see that? They call themselves a science, so they're using scientific methods, that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. So what I'm asking you, ladies and gentlemen, and please stay with me on this, I'm asking you, what kind of evidence would convince you that there are extraterrestrials? I'm not going to ask you to answer that, but I'd like you to be thinking about that. Lots of folks believe there are extraterrestrials. If you've followed the news lately, there are some new researches being done to find planets. Do you read science news? And they say they have found hundreds of planets now around stars out there in our galaxy, which say to them, well, that's possible then that there are life forms out there. So what are they looking for? SETI. How would they know there's some intelligence out there? Well, here's primarily what they're looking for. Virtually all radio SETI experiments have looked for what are now called narrow-band signals. Narrow-band radio signals is what they're looking for. These radio missions that are at one spot on the radio dial. If you listen to the radio in your car coming over this morning, you dial to a specific 97.6 or something like that. And when you did, music came across or speaking. Narrowband signals, they say, are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. Natural cosmic noisemakers such as pulsars and quasars do not make radio signals that are this narrow. So they would argue that if you were to receive from outer space a narrowband radio signal that had information in it, nature doesn't do that. That had to have an intelligent source. Is everybody with me? You're kind of sleepy this morning. I like active audiences. All right, so that's what they're looking for. They can then infer intelligent cause without necessarily identifying what that intelligence is. Right? Because what's their evidence? It's radio signals. That's all they've got. But they would argue if those radio signals are narrow band and contain information, that's pretty good evidence that that's an intelligent source out there, not a natural source. Okay? So, one of the fellows that really promoted this back when I was in college, my kids say that was before the flood, but it was not. It was in the 1960s. I was at Harvard University in the 1967-68 school year. And one of my professors, I had astronomy under one of the foremost radio astronomers of that time. He worked on a project, and Carl Sagan was heavily involved in that. Carl Sagan, I can tell you, really likes the idea that there are ETs. He wrote a big, thick book called Intelligent Life in the Universe in which he explored this subject. It was required reading in my class. Well, since I haven't found anything that would really support that notion yet, he wrote a book called Contact based on that idea. But it's fictional, ladies and gentlemen. Do you hear that? It's fiction. But in it, you see all those radio telescopes? The whole point of this book. Has anybody seen this movie? Or have you? Okay. Could you tell me what it was about? It got a little bit tedious, right? Somebody else seen it? Yeah, what did you get out of it? What was the main thrust of the book? The whole idea was they believed they had made contact with somebody out there in outer space, and it was based on this right here. This was the signal, the radio signal they received. Now, I understand this is fiction, but it makes a good story, and it also helps me make a point. So let me blow that up and show you that signal and explain it to you just a little bit, because I expect that doesn't make much sense to you. But the ones on that code represent bleeps on the radio telescope, narrowband bleeps. The zeros represent pauses. So if you follow with me, I'm going to underline some of this. And when you get the pattern, tell me, okay? And don't make me wait too long. There's two bleeps followed by a pause. Have you already got it? You saw a movie. All right, tell them then. What is the pattern? Yeah, these are all the prime numbers. 3 is the next prime number. Next is 5, then 7, then 11, 13. What's the next one? Anybody know? By the way, what's a prime number? Tell them. Number divisible by itself and 1, and that's all. Next prime number is 17, and then 19. So here they are. You see, what you have in this signal, ladies and gentlemen, is the first 25 prime numbers in a row. If you go down here to the bottom and you start with that pause right there and you count all these, the last one down here is 101. That's the 25th prime number in a row. Think about that. What if you received a signal from a certain point in outer space that contained the first 25 prime numbers in a row? What would you conclude? Isn't it interesting how the stars bleeped out the first 25 prime numbers? Nobody would conclude that. In fact, in this book, since this contained the sequence of the first 25 prime numbers in a row, everybody concluded that signal came from an intelligent source and they went looking to make contact with them. Okay, there's much more could be said about that. But I must move on. But you see the point, do you not? Please understand, that did not happen. But if it did happen, it'd be in every headline in the whole world. And everybody would be concluding there really are ETs. Okay. My point would be this. What if we received a message from outer space in one of those narrowband signals that had a language in it? And we learned how to decode that language and read it. And maybe it said, "We're out here, come find us." I don't think anybody would think, isn't it interesting what stars did? Or planets. We would start looking for who is out there trying to find us. Well, here's my point. We've got signs of intelligent design right here on Earth. We don't have to go to outer space. Every living cell is full of signs of intelligent design. In fact, every living cell includes a language that we have learned to decode and read. So why is it that folks say, well, every cell, isn't it interesting how nature just evolved that particular phenomenon? But that's exactly what's said. You would never say that if you got such a signal from outer space. But every living cell has that in it. And research on DNA continues to reveal signs of design. And that's what I want to talk to you about for a few minutes. But first, let me give you a quote from a gentleman named Anthony Flew, professor of philosophy, former atheist for 40 years. He debated creationists and belittled them for the very idea that they would suggest there was a creator. In 2004, here's what he said. He was 80 years old. "It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design." Professor Flew says, "I give up." There had to be a designer behind this. Well, I appreciate an 80-year-old man who openly debated against belief in God, now admitting that the evidence is overwhelming. There aren't very many folks like that. I hope I'm that open-minded and willing to look at things. What he said was, I had to go where the evidence leads. Isn't that purely the evidence of essence of science? You let the evidence take you where it leads? Do you know what's happened in our world, ladies and gentlemen? We have excluded the only other possible alternative. That's out. Because folks are saying, that's not science, that's religion. The only thing you can do in science is natural causes. And if you step over into another realm, you've stepped outside of science. I disagree with that. The folks who invented science as we know it were believers in God, and it didn't hurt their science. Now, you don't want to go into a science classroom and quote Genesis 1, I don't think. That's not the way science works. Let science lead you to the evidence of the natural world that points to design. That's how I'd suggest you do it. But that's excluded. Did you know you can't teach intelligent design in most high schools? Because it's considered religion. Well, it depends on who's teaching it as to how it's approached. But I am convinced you can approach this subject from a scientific perspective. It would be much like the SETI organization looking for evidence of intelligence out there in the universe. Is that science? I think it is. So here we go. This is a brief chemistry lesson. Are you ready for this? Everybody knows DNA has a certain characteristic structure, I think. Probably there's nobody in this room that hasn't had some study of this now in your lifetime. So I'm going to go rather quickly because I have several points to make. It is a double helix with crossbars. You see this intertwined helix here and see the cross pieces? And because of that structure discovered in... Anybody know when the structure of DNA was first discovered? Two famous people received credit for it. Who knows their names? Watson and Crick. Francis Crick and James Watson. 1953 is when they received the Nobel Prize for this. 53 now. This is 2011. So we've been almost 60 years now studying DNA. And it's been one of the greatest advances. You are so fortunate to be born in this time. We have learned more about how life functions in the last 60 years than all of the history of mankind before that put together. It is incredible what we've learned in 60 years. And my question to you at the beginning was, is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age, this age of enlightenment? This thing has the capacity to reproduce itself and pass on information from generation to generation. And it contains a language that we've learned how to read. Amazing. Here's how DNA transcribes itself, briefly. You see here the two intertwined cords, and you see they come apart. They unzip, and it exposes two sides here. So the DNA unzips, it exposes a side. It has a particular order of four molecules on that exposed side, A, C, G, and T. You don't have to learn this. If you were in my chemistry class, you would learn it. You would memorize it, and you'd memorize their chemical structure, and you'd understand exactly why A always fits with, does anybody know? A always fits with T, and C always fits with G. They go together like love and marriage and a horse and carriage. And that's the way that thing works. These can be read in sequence, and every three letters makes one word. This is a language that has only three-letter words. That would be kind of nice, isn't it? Easy language. Four letters, use three at a time. Now, you know the math on this. If you can take four letters and you can repeat any letters you want, you've got only four letters, and you can make three-letter words. How many words can you make? little probability here, combinations. What you do is you take the first position of your three-letter word can have how many choices? Four. The second position has four, and the third position has four. So how many letters can you make? Four times four times four, which is, mathematicians, 64 words. There are exactly 64 words in this language. And every word is three letters. And we know exactly what they mean. I will tell you, folks, if we received a signal from outer space that contained 64 three-letter words and we were able to decode what it meant, nobody on earth would think, isn't it interesting what nature did? Everybody would think, somebody intelligent out there. But this is in every cell, and nature somehow did this. Here's a little bit about how it works. The DNA unzips. You see this little purple thing here? That's called RNA polymerase. That is a protein that allows it to unzip. My, I wish I had about 3 hours to tell you about this. It's so fascinating. It's absolutely overwhelming. It takes about 50 proteins to make this thing work, to build proteins. The purpose for this language, it's pretty clear to us now, is to build proteins. That's what those 64 words are for. And I'm going to show you a little bit about that. But here tells you how they're copied. See this strand that's exposed here? This is called a transcribed strand. The other one's not transcribed. So we thought. Can I interrupt myself here just a minute? In the last 10 to 15 years, we've learned that both sides are transcribed. And a whole lot of other stuff we didn't know 15 years ago. So this is an ongoing story. And it is absolutely and utterly overwhelming to point to design, in my view. That's why I love to talk about it. All right. Well, there's so much more could be said, but you notice what's happening is this side is being copied here, and the copy is called RNA. In fact, it's called messenger RNA. And it is an exact mirror image copy of what's on here. So everywhere you have a G over here, you have a C over there. Everywhere you have an A over here, you have a U over here. U replaces the T. And so you get a copy then of this information on this messenger RNA, which is then released, and it can go somewhere else and take the information and do something with it. Sounds like a plan to me. Not an accident. And here is the language, ladies and gentlemen. So if you were studying genetic code language in my class, you're learning a new language. And this one chart has the whole language in it. That's all there is to this language. It's 64 words, pardon me. So let me show you how this works. If you think that's the first letter, this is, by the way, RNA language. The four letters are U, C, A, and G. The U replaces the T. That's a long subject. Don't ask me to discuss it today. But uracil replaces thymine. All right, here's the second position. Suppose that's your second letter in your three-letter word. This is your third letter in your three-letter word. So put them together. Suppose you had the first letter is U, the second letter is U, and the third letter is U. This is what it means right here. Did you get that? So if I may pronounce those words, ooh means fee. Try another one. U-U-G. U-U-G. That's oog. It means loo. This is not very helpful, is it? But if you understood it, it would be very helpful. Because what you have up here, ladies and gentlemen, is a code for all the 20 common amino acids that build proteins in every living thing. Now, can you see we need about a week to explain all of that? This is a brief overview. Did you know that every protein in your body is constructed from 20 amino acids? As it is in every other living thing. These are the 20 common amino acids. Their names are phenylalanine, leucine, serine, cysteine, tyrosine. They're all on here. Valine, alanine, aspartame, glutamine, glycine. They're all up there. There are exactly 20 of them. We have 64 words, so there's some repeats. Looks like a backup system to me. What you have, ladies and gentlemen, is a code for all 20 amino acids. When you put two amino acids together in a long string, you get a protein. So what you have here is the code for building proteins in living things. Utterly amazing. But that's not all there is to this code. You see, if you watch this just briefly, here's the DNA up here that contains the code. Here's the messenger RNA that's being copied, and then it carries it outside the nucleus out here to the ribosomes. It's read through the ribosomes, and then out comes the protein out the bottom. So the information that's stored up here is transported, that's called migration, and down here it's translated so that you can build proteins. And every step of that process requires proteins to make it happen. All right, you ready? I've got a techie guy that's going to help me here. And if you would, can we get these lights dimmed a little bit so this shows up better? I'm going to show you a little 3D video that came from a website that has to advertise this book, Signature in the Cell. Look, if you're chemically oriented and you're interested in this subject, you need this book. It's a very current book written by Stephen Meyer on the evidence of intelligent design in every cell. It's called Signature in the Cell. You remember the SETI organization is looking for some signature of the technology out there? You can find some signature of intelligent design in every living cell. And he describes it in great detail in this book. This is the website, and there's a little video clip from it, and we're going to talk to you now about how this works. See the DNA strand here. And what Phil's going to do is let this run till I tell him to stop it. Stop. You didn't stop. Thank you. You got to be quicker than that, Phil. Yeah. All right. Do you see right here the A, C, G, and T? These are the letters that I told you about. That's four bases that code for the language on the DNA. And so it's on this strand here. That's where the information is contained. Okay, let's go now. You can see it winding there, and this is down inside the nucleus of every cell, and the code is actually there. And what happens now is it begins to unzip. Stop it right there. This is that RNA polymerase I told you about. It's a group of proteins that ride along the DNA. And what they do is they unzip it, allow it to be copied, and then zip it back together. There's much to be said about that, that we really ought to describe to you. And we don't have the time to do it today. But may I tell you that there's even a specialized protein there. Have you ever gotten a zipper stuck? Well, see, DNA is long and convoluted. And when you try to unzip it, it's very easy for it to get messed up. There's a specific protein specifically to keep it lined up so it doesn't get messed up. And there's so much more to tell you about that. What I'm telling you, folks, is this is a well-oiled machine that functions at phenomenal rates of speed. Okay, go ahead now. So it's riding along and unzipping and letting the thing be transcribed. Now we're going to go down inside. This is more what it looks like. Stop. You see that strand coming out the back there? That's your messenger RNA. It's being copied down inside there. It's getting the information off the DNA, and then it's getting released out into the protoplasm. All right, let's go down inside now. Go ahead, Phil. Now we're down inside. You see here, this is the little pieces coming up, and one by one, copying the information and forming this messenger RNA strand that takes the information off the DNA, and then it's released out into the protoplasm. Stop. So down inside this complex, all that's going on, and the copied information is being released out into the protoplasm of the nucleus. Okay? Now, go ahead, Phil. Here it is. Now, see, it's got to migrate. It's moving somewhere. Stop right there. There's much more happening between that step and this step that I'm not even talking to you about. And would you please understand that every step of this process, there's 68 other things I ought to tell you, each of which are amazing. We're skipping all kinds of stuff. Forgive me, living cells, for the poor job I'm doing. I'm just trying to get the main picture across to you. All right, when this thing migrates, you see those holes there? That's the edge of the nuclear cell wall. That's around the edge of the nucleus. It has holes in it. That's not a good thing, is it? I mean, that means you could let stuff come in and out just at will. Well, that's not the way it works. When you go up to that hole there, like this one right here, that hole has a guardian of the gate. That is another very specialized protein that only allows certain things to go through and other things are blocked. It's another part of the system, ladies and gentlemen. So let's go slowly now. I mean, Phil, go ahead and be sure and stop when I tell you. Here we go. You see that it's migrating over to the hole there. Do you notice this little circular thing here? That's a protein. And watch, it's going to open up. See that? Stop. It opens up and allows the messenger RNA to pass through. That's a very specialized protein specifically for that function. And folks, every protein in this process, of which there are at least 50 different ones, is specialized for that particular step. I get excited about this. And you tell me this all came about by natural causes. Okay, keep going. So here now, and by the way, when that thing gets through there, it closes back up. And the next guy that comes through that's not a messenger RNA, stop. It's a, you're not getting through here. So now, here's the messenger RNA outside the nuclear wall here, and it's migrating out here to the ribosomes. So, okay, let's go ahead now. Here the migration continues. Much more to be said during this process, but here it comes up to the ribosomes, and notice how it closes in on it. Stop right there. These ribosomes that in that other picture look like two ducks hugging each other it's obviously a molecular structure. And this thing here is read through it, kind of like a tape through a tape player. Remember the old cassette players? I have to say the old cassette players used to have tapes that ran through them and it read the information off of it. That's what happens here. And it's still happening even though we have CDs and DVDs now. This happens every microsecond. Okay, go ahead. So now the thing is being read like a tape in a tape player, and stop right there. This is down inside now, and you see here's the first code letter, CAC. Well, the ribosomes know exactly what that means. CAC means one of the 20 amino acids. And it means go get me one of those amino acids floating around in the cell. That's why you better eat your amino acids or you don't build proteins. Some of them are made by your body, some are not. You better get a good balance. Okay, so here's a transfer RNA. Have I even talked about that? No, I haven't. That's another thing we left out. But there's transfer RNA that goes outside in the cytoplasm, picks up the, let's call it alanine, which is the amino acid coded right there. And do you notice this is the exact reflection of that? This exact code reflects that exact code as a mirror image, and it brings up the specific amino acid called for by that three-letter word. Then you move to the next three-letter word, AGA, and that means valine, let's just say, or isoleucine. Then you get a specific transfer RNA that brings up isoleucine, hooks it on here. Go ahead now just a little bit. Stop right there. And now you see we have a three-chain protein, three amino acids, because you've read the first three letters, words, in this code. Okay? Then what do you think happens next? Well, you read the next three-letter word, and here comes the next one. Go ahead. Here comes the next transfer RNA with its three-letter code. Here comes the next one, and here's the next one. Stop right there. Now we have about a 6-amino acid protein. Folks, do you know how big an average of protein is? Anybody want to guess? An average protein has how many amino acids in a string? 1,000! Proteins are huge, generally. There's some small ones, and there's some really, really huge ones, but on the average, they're about 1,000 amino acids in a row. So this picture here that's trying to show you how you build that protein, this is the protein being built down here. It's going way too slow. So what he tries to do on this video is speed it up a little bit. So let's watch. Go ahead, Phil. So here we go. Way too slow. Putting those together. It's not, there's no way. Keep going. Speed that silly thing up. Go! Move it! That's much better, but still way too slow. Stop. You know how long it takes to build a protein that's 1,000 amino acids long in your cell? Microseconds! Since you've been sitting here listening to me, your cells in your body, of which you have billions, have been building proteins at an enormous rate, about 200,000 per second. No wonder you get tired just sitting there. And that's what's happening inside your cells. And it is guided by the information in the DNA, by the RNA copying it, by the transfer RNA helping the copies be used, and by about 50 proteins. Folks, Henry Ford never put together a factory that would touch this. And you ever seen a car built in microseconds? This is going on constantly in every living cell. Okay, now let's keep going here, because the story's not finished. You see, here's the messenger RNA, and here's the protein coming out the bottom, and you notice that it's kind of winding up, and it proceeds over here to another organism inside the cell in the cytoplasm, and inside that organism, it is reshaped into a specific three-dimensional shape. When it gets white, stop. No, it's not white yet. Boom. It is just finished, making it into an exact three-dimensional shape. You see, because a protein, ladies and gentlemen, is not just a string of amino acids like this. It's a string of amino acids that's been reshaped into a specific three-dimensional form. And if it isn't shaped like that, it doesn't work. Well, there's another bunch of proteins involved in that process. And then when that's done, go ahead, the finely shaped protein is now released out into the cytoplasm to go forth and do the work for which it was designed. Stop. It's interesting to me that when you read textbooks about this, they'll talk about it goes forth and does the work it was designed for. And then they say, no, this wasn't designed. This wasn't designed. Nature did this. It's incredible to me that intelligent people look at this and say, nature did that by itself with no guidance whatsoever. Now, I must tell you, and this is where I want to get to next. How much time do we have? When do we stop? Oh, no. I got 3 minutes. All right, this is going to be the fastest treatment in history. What happens, and here's what I believe is the truth about it. Every time we discover something new in science about the natural world that indicates God exists, something's going to happen that makes you think maybe it doesn't happen. It doesn't work that way. It's happened over and over again. I almost believe it's like 2 Thessalonians 2, where God says, if you don't love the truth, he'll send you a strong delusion that you believe a lie. Here's what's happened with DNA. Now, let's go back to my... Can you go back to my slides real quick? I'm going to toggle back. Good. What about junk DNA? You heard the expression? I've been hit by this many times in my conferences and discussions with evolutionists. they say, junk DNA. Did you know, Professor Payne, that that whole process you just described for building proteins only takes about 5% of the entire DNA? What about the other 95%? Some say that the other 95% of the DNA is junk. And why would a creator, some intelligent designer, design something that's 95% junk? You all know, don't you, that in the last 10 years we've mapped the whole human genome? And you know what we found? We found in it long sequences of repetitive stuff, just like it's the same stuff over and over and over and over again. We found stuff in it that looks like the leftovers of something that once worked and now doesn't work. You listening? And it looks like the great mass of DNA, although this 5% is amazing what it does. The rest of it looks like the leftovers of an evolutionary process, so they say. And the junk DNA argument for the last 10 to 15 years has been used over and over again to belittle creationists. So you really think your God did this when it's full of junk? And I will tell you, young people and older folks, I didn't know how to answer that. And I've experienced this through my lifetime, where I've hit up against things I didn't know how to deal with. It sure didn't look favorable for the creation position. And I think we need to be honest about that. There's plenty of questions, if you ask me, I don't know the answer to. But I will tell you this. What I have learned is if you give it about 20 years, a lot of new stuff unfolds. And that is precisely what's happened with junk DNA. And I'd highly recommend this new little book by Jonathan Wells called The Myth of Junk DNA. Jonathan Wells is a biochemist, molecular biologist, who works at the University of Southern California. He's a respected scientist, but he's a creationist. And what he does is he cites all the studies. He cites over 1,000 different studies in the last 10 years that show what that junk does. And yet the argument is still being made. I was at USF not too long ago, and a professor stood up after I did my lecture. He said, now, Professor Payne, you haven't told this audience. You know, they kind of look down on you. They think on me as like a flat earther because I dare to believe in creation still in this enlightened age. He said, no, you haven't told this audience about the fact that most of the DNA is junk. And how would you explain that from a creationist standpoint? And you know what I said? I said, dear sir, you need to be careful what you call junk. Maybe what you should say is, we are ignorant of its function. And maybe we'll learn eventually what it does. And by the way, do you know that there's a lot of evidence now that that junk does stuff for the body? And that there are many functions that supposed junk DNA carries out that are vital? And we're just beginning to learn what all that does, so be careful what you call junk. My experience is we need to be a little more humble and say we just don't know what's going on here yet. And is there any evidence from the history of science that maybe we've overstated our case sometimes? Well, there was a professor in 1850 who said your human body is a veritable leftover. It's a museum of your evolutionary past. Because it's got 150 vestigial organs that used to function and now don't. That was the story in the 1850s on up to the middle of the 1900s. Until we began discovering what all those 150 things did. And now we're down to maybe two. And even those are questionable. So I say, be careful what you call junk. And you read this book and you'll find out that that 95% does things like this. There are multiple messages stored in the same sequence of bases. There are spliceosomes and exosomes that have code that help you find a code within a code. Dual and overlapping messages. Here's what we're finding out, ladies and gentlemen, that one strand of DNA, when you chop it off and you get that piece of it, it can make about 1,000 different proteins, the same piece. because it's reworked and managed by all this junk that supposedly wasn't doing anything. Utterly incredible. It's much like a letter that was written back in the Revolutionary War, and he uses that illustration in this book. The letter talked about what was going on in the farm. But if you knew the code, you could read that same letter and figure out what the military was doing behind enemy lines. So there was a code within a code. That's what you've got in DNA so far, we're learning. Now I've got to skip over really fast. But it's not just that. There are files within folder systems making retrieving, manipulating, and expressing the data more efficient. It's like words, sentences, and paragraphs. You have genes and gene folders and superfolders. And then, not only that, the organism provides a context. DNA alone does not wholly determine the morphology, form, and organisms. Cell types, organs, and body plans all have a part in this that we're just beginning to learn. So be careful what you call junk. Here's what I'd say to you. We're just beginning to figure out that the rest of that DNA probably is like a giant operating system that helps manage all this information. It's utterly amazing. If SETI received a message from space containing nothing but the genetic code, they would certainly conclude intelligent design. But what about the code with all the stuff it does to build proteins? No wonder Dr. Flew gave up. If you follow the evidence where it leads, the only reasonable answer is this was designed by an intelligent designer. Everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they are made. Everywhere you see a loud, clear, piercing cry of design, as Michael Behe says in his famous book, Darwin's Black Box. So I say to you, it's more reasonable than ever to believe in God. In fact, how could anybody miss it if they did nothing but read the book of the natural world? And that's the lesson. Thank you for your attention.